It started as writing. And right from the beginning, you knew this was different. Because it was happening in small villages, market towns. And then it wasn't on the TV anymore. It was in the street outside. It was coming through your windows. It was a virus, an infection. You didn't need a doctor to tell you that. It was the blood. Something in the blood. By the time they tried to evacuate the cities, it was already too late. The infection was everywhere. The army blockades were overrun. And that's when the extras started.
Welcome to Now Playing's bonus retrospective series, watching and reviewing 28 Days Later and its sequel, 28 Weeks Later.
The answer to infection. It's here, though it may not be quite what you imagined.
Hosted by Arnie.
He's telling me he'll never bake bread, plant crops, raise livestock. He's telling me he's futureless.
Stuart.
Am I one of them? No, you're not.
And Jacob.
I think they're good people.
That's nice, but you should be more concerned about whether they're going to slow you down.
This podcast will contain detailed plot spoilers and harsh language. Listener discretion is advised.
It's all fucked. You hear it all on the radio. It's fucked.
Today we're discussing 28 Weeks Later, starring Robert Carlyle, Rose Byrne, Jeremy Renner, Idris Elba, Imogen Poots, and directed by Juan Carlos Fresnadillo. I'm Arnie, co-host of Now Playing, and I run this place. Or I'm just the custodian.
Stuart in LA.
This is Jacob, and I'm ready to execute Code Red.
All right, I'm glad you've got your Mountain Dew, and a Mountain Dew probably paid for thanks to the donations of our generous, generous listeners.
That's true. We've kind of reached the end of our gold donation series. Even though we got one more show next week, this was a very special podcast for those that were able to find $25. Not always easy to do. I know I don't have it some weeks. I am truly grateful that you guys wanted to hear what we had to say so badly on Return of the Living Dead and with 28 Weeks Later.
And this one came out a long time after the first one. 6 years.
I'm shocked it took so long because that first film, it was a surprise hit. I mean, isn't Hollywood supposed to spit these out right away?
Well, this isn't quite a Hollywood production, and it's a little deceptive. The movie came out in 2002 in England, but American audiences saw it in summer 2003. It wasn't quite 6 years. It was more like five. But it took a long time, and I didn't know that there was going to be any more. It felt like such a satisfying experience. I didn't necessarily feel like, oh yeah, they're just going to franchise this out and make endless sequels to it. I hoped that they would, but I had no idea what that story would look like if they should ever choose to return to Jim, Selena, and Hannah.
But they didn't return to Jim, Selena, and Hannah. They looked at doing that. They looked at doing 29 Days Later. They looked at returning to those characters, but be it the story or be it availability of actors and director, all of whom were working on other things at the time, they ended up going weeks later with an all-new cast, and I have to say I was really disappointed in that. I remember when the trailers for 28 Weeks Later came out, and I wasn't sure if it would have the same characters or not. In fact, it is one of the first movie reviews we did here at Now Playing. It is episode 2 of Now Playing, way back in the archives.
So you mean they didn't have to pay for this podcast? You just totally ripped them off. You already said what you thought with Marjorie way back in the day.
Yeah.
I haven't heard it. I probably should just stop now and go listen. They're usually pretty short in the beginning, but I didn't realize that. Okay.
And that was the only time I've seen this movie until today. So I saw it in theaters when it opened in 2007. And now.
Yeah, I saw this opening weekend. I was excited for it, even though it was 5, 6 years, whatever, after that 28 Days Later. I really loved that film. I don't think I had too much of a hold to Jim and Selena, all them. I just wanted another film that provided that kind of experience. So my butt was in that seat opening weekend.
Yeah, I saw it opening weekend in theaters, and like you, Jacob, the fact that it wasn't Jim wasn't so much of a problem. I felt like that story was complete, honestly, depending on which ending you take. I mean, it was really complete. Maybe Jim's dead to you. Maybe it's all over. You know, I got the sense that what they were doing with those characters is finished. And what alarmed me more was that the creative team behind the first movie wasn't returning. That, yeah, Danny Boyle wasn't in the director's chair, and that the screenwriter, Alex Garland, he wasn't penning this story. They were off making a sci-fi movie called Sunshine, and they gave this to newbies. You know, I didn't really know who Juan Carlos Fernandello really was. So I did go back after this movie and watch his debut, Intacto, but I did not know who he was when I went to the theater. It was what drew me was the promise of having another intense, scary movie like the first one. And that was really it.
Yeah, and he hasn't really worked again since.
I made some Clive Owen horror movie that no one seemed to like called Intruders. But yeah, this was sort of a brief flash of notoriety and then nothing. You know, I always think it's interesting, too, when they make a big sequel to a movie that was kind of small. 28 Days Later, it wasn't a micro-budgeted film. I mean, they had more money than Blair Witch or Paranormal Activity. But in the scheme of things, it was really modest. It felt like guys running around London with video cameras, kind of doing it on a whim. And now, based on the success of that first movie, they're flooded with cash. You can feel it in the whole production, with camera movements that they weren't able to pull off before, just scope, special effect shots. The things they do here, this is a bigger scale. Not only has more time passed, there has been more put into this production. They've really gotten bigger. Not necessarily better, but they've definitely upped their game here. I always think that's a dicey proposition. What was charming about that first one was its modesty, was that it was a small-scale story about a few people. What will it feel like now that we're going all of London? You know, this story really plays out as a road trip through an entire city here. It's daring. A lot of things here to be alarmed about, intrigued about, impressed about. It is not a rote sequel. I'll give you that. If nothing else, 28 Weeks Later has ambition to spare.
Yeah, just to put it in perspective, though, this wasn't a $100 million movie. The last one cost around 10. This one's estimated to have cost around 15. Keep in mind also, 5 years later, CGI got a hell of a lot better in 5 years and a hell of a lot cheaper in 5 years. So I think they were just able to do a lot more with their money. And God knows they weren't spending it on the cast. I was completely stunned. When I reviewed this movie in 2007, I didn't know who anyone in this cast was except Harold Perrineau, who is from Lost, and he'd been fired from that show. Now I'm looking, I'm like, oh my god, it's Hawkeye, it's Myra McTaggart from the X-Men, it's Heimdall from Thor, and hey, it's Imogen Poots, whose name we made fun of ruthlessly in the Fright Night remake.
I remember that. I love that name still. Still the very best name I've ever gotten to say. Imogen Poots. Great. It's great. Yes, this is a cast of people that not only do I know now, I respect. A lot of these people, I think, have done good work in their time since getting their training wheels here. In returning to this, part of the joy is being able to see before they were stars or before they were stars to me.
Yeah, I was surprised because Jeremy Renner's known for being fairly stoic, and in the behind-the-scenes footage, he's just happy to be there.
It's always nice to have a job when you're starting out.
Keep in mind, he's really only 2 years away from an Oscar nomination. A Hurt Locker would change a lot for him, and there's a lot of Hurt Locker here in this movie.
Yeah, I agree with you, Stuart. Now, having seen Hurt Locker, definitely saw those beginnings here with this role.
It almost plays like an audition tape.
Well, Stuart, you said you were worried because Boyle wasn't back and Garland wasn't back. They both produced this, but I did find out during my research that Boyle was a little bit more hands-on. He was on the set. He even directed some second unit stuff that's in the film. Some of the action scenes were directed by Boyle. So his guiding hand was there, even if he was focused on a different project.
Sure. And you can feel that once you see the movie. I definitely feel like you are in solid hands, and that what I like about the original does carry on here. There's a through line, even though there feels like a lot of different people involved. Yeah. I mean, why don't you just get into it, Arnie? Why don't you tell them what happened 28 weeks later?
Okay, they run it down. And let's talk, just before I do a plot summary, about what happened between the movies. Because they really start off with cue cards telling us what happened. There was the infection, which we saw in the prologue of 28 Days Later. And at 15 days is when they quarantined Britain. So what was being postulated last time, that Britain being an island was quarantined and infection hadn't left the island, that's confirmed here. Then at the 28 days mark, when Jim woke up, that's what the outside world just determines London is destroyed. But 5 weeks later, around the time Jim was rescued, the infected had died of starvation, and at 11 weeks, a US-led NATO force entered London. Kind of topical in 2007 when a US-led force goes into a former war region. At 18 weeks, London was declared completely free of infection. At 24 weeks, they started rebuilding London. And then at 28 weeks, we get this film. And two people brought back to start their life again are young siblings Andy and Tammy, whose father Don survived during the infection, and he's now a custodian for the tower where the returning Londoners live. But Don holds a secret. He, his wife Alice, and some other survivors hold up in a country house during the infection. When the infected break into the house, Don left his wife behind to save himself, and he was the only survivor. A fact he, for obvious reasons, doesn't want to tell his kids. But his lies start to surface when Andy and Tammy sneak out of the compound to go to their old home and gather some personal belongings, and they find their mother there. She's been bitten and infected, but not crazed with rage virus. It turns out she has a natural immunity to the virus, but she is a carrier. The NATO force takes Alice for examination, and scientist Scarlet sees Alice as a key to the cure for infection. But when Don goes to visit his wife, they kiss, and her saliva infects Don, making him the first infected in London in many weeks. He goes on a rampage and infects dozens, then hundreds of people in the compound. So U.S. Army leader Stone orders a code red: purge everyone in the compound, infected or not. Army sniper Doyle doesn't sit well with that order, and when he sees Andy among the people he should shoot, he abandons his post and joins Scarlet, Andy, Tammy, and a few other people who are just there for body count as they try to escape. Doyle's friend Flynn is a chopper pilot and tells Doyle to meet him, and Doyle, Scarlet, and the group get to the rendezvous, attacked by military and infected alike along the way, but Flynn's chopper can't handle the weight of all the people. When the affected attack, Flynn is forced to leave the group. But the pilot radios Doyle and says to meet up at Wembley Stadium, but leave the civvies behind. Doyle ignores the last part, and the group again goes after the chopper. And Doyle and the nameless people die, and eventually it's down to Scarlet, Andy, and Tammy. They flee into the London Underground, where they're again attacked by infected Don. Don kills Scarlet and bites Andy before being shot and killed by Tammy. But Andy shares his mother's immunity, and he and Tammy make it to Flynn's chopper in the stadium, and the three take off for safety. But 28 days after that, we see the infected have used the tunnel and made their way from London to Paris. The French radio for help, and we see the infected going nuts at the Eiffel Tower as credits roll. So a lot of continuity in there. They even went further. They actually, on the Blu-ray, had some motion comics that I was able to watch that was a prologue and an epilogue to 28 Days Later, exploring even further the origins of the rage virus and then London after the breakout. I guess these were actual comic books that were adapted to motion comics for home video release.
Yeah, and right before this film, to kind of bridge the gap between the two, they did 28 Days Later Aftermath, and they explored, yeah, like you said, the origins of the virus and follows one of the scientists throughout. It's kind of four stories broken up, and it covers this time and gets a bit more into it if you're into that kind of thing.
Part of me did want to know more, but I think it's the right choice. It's certainly a bold choice that they largely withhold that from this movie. They really keep the perspective of the man on the street they had with Jim here in this movie. We don't know too much more about the virus. Some wordage is given to the fact that we know it's not airborne, it didn't jump species, but we really don't know too much more than what we knew from that monkey crashing opening scene from the first movie. I think it's the right choice. I like the fact that the perspective, our innocence, caught in the middle. I think it's more terrifying that way when you don't have the expertise of knowledge.
Yeah, I couldn't tell if it was that the characters didn't necessarily know or if it was just a matter of, we kind of covered this in the prologue of the first one, let's gloss over it. And here, more than ever, I feel like they're really channeling zombies with the infected. In the opening scene, we see them breaking in. They want to eat your flesh. There are comments made later in the movie about how the infected aren't hungry for food, they're hungry for flesh. They definitely have gone more the zombie route, and by 2007, this movie helped reignite the zombie craze in 2002. By 2007, it's just secondhand. We don't need to really go into it.
Yeah, I definitely got more of a zombie vibe with this film. You know, we still don't have the infected raising up if they don't get shot in the head. But yeah, there's the swarms of them going after people, breaking through the house, much like those Romero films. It does have much more of a standard zombie feel with the way the attacks go down.
Yeah, you can't get much more Romero than a remote cottage being besieged by people that want to eat you. And I've never noticed the difference. You know, it had to be pointed out to me last podcast. They don't get up after they're dead. They're so scary and tough. I just presume that nothing could stop them. It feels that way. It feels like the best you can do is run in this circumstances. And man, do they give us a chase scene here in the opening of this. If I had any concerns about this living up to the previous movie, this opener is as grabbing as anything they did in 28 Days Later.
I'm of dual minds on this opening. When the action gets going, it's definitely very exciting, but it starts off with this long period where it's a husband and wife in the cabin, and I think the filmmakers just assume you've seen the first one, you get what's going on, you get about the infected. This is during the infection, this prologue, so we don't know about London being repopulated. That's not happening yet, but there's just these two people alone in a cabin. But they never reference the infected. It's this long cooking scene. And then suddenly strangers start walking in, and then you definitely have a Night of the Living Dead feel, as it's just this weird, disparate group of people who would never hang out together unless they were literally sheltering for their lives.
I love that about it. It almost feels romantic. If someone said, hey, let's go see a movie, and you walked in cold, you might think you're up for one of those chick flicks or something, with the way it starts with a candlelit dinner, and then all of a sudden there's an old couple and some strange dude crashing on the couch, and the buzz is totally killed. I like the slow reveal here. It mirrors how we learned about it from Jim. You know, he didn't wake up wrestling somebody with red eyes. It took him a little while to see what was going on.
Well, I think in Jim's case, we got some great cinematography, him in this empty London. I agree, Arnie, it's a little slow, but then we do finally get to that great imagery. You get the boy knocking on the door, and they open it up. You know, you think it's nighttime, this place is pitch black, and to see this bright sun shining through and they're blinded, that's just a very powerful, quick, few-second scene, but it tells you so much.
Yeah, and it is the conflict of the movie. I didn't realize it at the time, but a boy being chased by his parents who want to kill him is exactly what this story is about. They're faking us out here. I'm believing that this is going to be a story about lovers on the run trying to make it, but Don and Alice are going to fall by the wayside here. It's the fact that the child's in peril is really what they're sending here. And this, to me, is as great as anything in the last one. I don't think it's slow at all. I think that the whole thing is just creepy and dreadful, and once it gets going, just grab your armrest, terrifying.
Yeah, and I'll say that first film, the unsettling imagery, that's what really got me. I think it got all of us. What a reaction we had to it. And when we see Don, like, jump out the window and leave his wife and this kid behind, see his wife looking from that window during this rage attack, that is hitting me in the gut. I get, rationally, that's probably the best choice. That's probably the smart thing to do. Selena would have done that at the beginning of 28 Days Later. But man, that hits you in the gut, leaving your wife and a small child behind to get eaten.
It's an image they'll repeat again and again. A character pressed up against glass, looking for help. It's something that they use, and it becomes a motif. And you're right, it's brilliant that it's this haunting thing that will stay with Don. And it's hard to blame him, particularly since we have seen the last movie. And we do know, by Selena logic, that, yeah, other people get you killed. There was not much that he could have done unless he was willing to lay down his life. What he wasn't willing to do was to lay down his life for the chance to get his wife out. That is his quote-unquote crime. I gotta ask, are you guys judgmental of that?
I'm torn, because watching the scene, I completely get what he's thinking. Because the kid is on the other side of the room, and he and his wife are there. And they're both leaving. She chooses to go back for the kid. We later find out she's a mother, so maybe there was a maternal instinct going on. And he tries to urge her on and say, leave the kid. And so when she goes, he then becomes more conflicted. We saw them having that romantic dinner. We know he loves her, and he doesn't go back. The question is there anything he could have done? And you say lay down his life. Could he have helped in any other way? Could they all have escaped? Probably not. Could they have all boarded up in that room? Probably not. Is it a cold-hearted fucking thing to do? To go, well, there's my wife, and go. I think it's the casualness with which he does it. He pauses for a beat, and then he just never looks back. He does look back and sees his wife get sucked away and just runs harder.
Yeah, but that's the nature of regret, is that it happens in a heartbeat, that it's instinctual, that your character is tested not by having all night to think about what you would do or what the right thing is to do. If he had had more time, he probably would have gone back for her, but there was no time. This opening scene is really where also we're told this is going to be a much grander visual experience. The cameraman they've got on this, they got crane shots. They've got incredible moves. There's aerial shots. As he's running to that boat, they're doing it by chopper, and they have this great special effect shot of him in profile running, and you see over the field masses of rage victims coming at a much faster rate than him. It's an incredible composition. It's an incredible use of camera. It matches anything that was done in the last film. And again, I say, this is a phenomenal opener. I knew he had to get away because he's Robert Carlyle. He's the star of the movie. But I just didn't see how, with the way that they just ratchet the tension.
And I think you're overselling it. I do like the chopper shot, but a lot of this action is just done with the shaky cam that is of that time. The first one had a handheld feel, and I kind of like a handheld feel, but this one had that, even in post, we're going to make things even shakier and have his head in and out of the frame and everything. That just turns me off. I'm not a fan of that aesthetic, and I understand it probably felt modern and hip, but I kind of think it's overused.
I'm not a big fan like you, Arnie, of the shaky cam, and especially when they added in post. But here, I realize that's going on, but I'm so into it, it's not bugging me. And I think that's a testament to the action of the way it's shot here, is that, you know, whenever a film does something that I typically dislike, but I'm going with it, that's a success. That means it's drawn me in.
Yeah, I think the camera's kinetic, and I think it's partly because they have machines and devices available to them they did not have on the budget they had last time.
It's a good opener, but I'm just not over the moon for it the way you are, Stuart. I thought it was good. I really liked the action. It definitely feels bigger, and I'm totally with this guy. He does try to help out Jacob. Jacob's at a boat. I don't know why the infected aren't attacking Jacob at the boat.
Funny enough, Jacob was the first victim. You know, after the girl goes to the window and gets bitten, she goes, rages out and goes on him. And it's Robert Carlyle that saves him, actually. He beats him off with a bat and gives the guy an opportunity to run off with the owners of the cottage to the barn. He gets all out. He goes through the roof. He really, a Herculean effort, really. But come on, you're not Robert Carlyle. You've never been nominated for an Oscar. You're not going to make it to that speedboat. I know that he's dead meat. I just don't know how Robert Carlyle's going to live.
And I'm wondering if Robert Carlyle's really going to help him. The extra weight, slow down the boat, but he does appear to genuinely try to help Jacob.
It's hard to say. It is a swirl of blood in the water. But I think there was an extension of hand at a moment. It's hard to know what anyone would do in a moment like this. It is sheer chaos. And again, it seems to be a theme of these movies that there is no way to kill the infected. You can only hope to run faster, have a good security system. There just is no way to stop them once they have your scent.
And even though I do think he tries to help Jacob, I also am pretty sure I heard the sound effect of Jacob's head hitting that propeller as the boat drives away.
He's chopped up by the boat, but I think he had already been bitten. He had certainly been grabbed. There was no pulling him up in the boat once you're infected. I mean, that would have just been suicide.
But keep in mind, if the infected get you, that doesn't mean you're infected. Oftentimes, they'll just kill you. It's only if you actually escape the infected that you live to become infected. So when he was pulled under and there was that big thing of blood, I took him as dead already. I didn't take him as turned.
Yeah. I thought he was dead already back in the cottage, but I just didn't know about Alice. That was really the surprise. I didn't realize everything would hinge on this relationship separation. And I didn't know she was coming back.
I do think the film keeps us at a distance from Don. I don't think it ever wants us to empathize too much. I mean, once he becomes infected, he's this reoccurring character that causes this passive outbreak. Yes, he's infected with this virus, but the way the movie chooses to portray him, going after his children to kill them, knowing that he left his wife behind and he lied about it. Like, again, rationally, logically, I could see those things, but when I'm watching a film, it's a much more emotional experience. And I think this film, wants us to be questioning him, doesn't ever want us to be really on his side.
Yeah, it could even be read that because he makes this choice, that's why he's going to get infected later, that it does come back to get him. In the end, him running from this situation, when he's reunited, he doesn't get away. But we don't know this at the time. Let's face it, Robert Carlyle is a pretty big star as far as British movies go. You know, Full Monty. We'd seen him as the bad guy in World Is Not Enough. I had no idea that he would not be our Jim in this movie. I was fully prepared to watch his redemption story for the rest of it. It's one of the many great fool-outs that we have that at the midpoint, he becomes the bad guy. I just never saw that coming.
I saw it coming the first time I watched it, if memory serves, because his action here, I was surprised that he comes back later. It feels like a great opening prologue, but then we do cut to a totally different situation. When he shows up again, that was a little bit startling, but the way his kids treat him, the fact that Tammy just seems to hold him in contempt anyway and not believe his lies, and the fact that he lies so casually, and he's just such a bullshit artist. I run the place. He's a janitor. He has the janitor badges that get him in all the doors. I instantly know that that first impression is supposed to be the one that lasts with us. This guy is a dick. Now, is he going to turn into the main zombie? That I don't see coming. But I thought at least he was going to be the bald guy from Night of the Living Dead.
I can't believe you're saying this about kindly little Robert Carlyle. This is a very likable character actor. I never saw him as a dick. Did he make the wrong choice? Sure. But I definitely didn't think that the kids judged him for it. They believe him.
No, they don't.
Yes, they do. They absolutely do.
Tammy gives him that look. She just gives him dead eyes and goes, "We're just happy you're still alive." She does not believe him.
No, I disagree. And I think that it's imperative that we understand that she does believe him so that when the betrayal happens, it's a real shocker for her. She does not believe that he left this woman behind. She has to take the face value. I mean, I think she just thinks it's alarming. The look you're talking about that she's giving him is just the horror of realizing that her mom is dead. It's been confirmed, which is a lot. Now, Arnie, you said that some of your favorite stuff in the first movie was of empty London. It is here. It just wasn't in the opening prologue. It is as we pick up with the story with the repopulation 28 weeks later, and we get a lot of ghostly imagery that I think is just as effective. Watching people scrape off SOS messages from rooftops and seeing all the security camera stuff, seeing a large city where snipers at that are on the rooftops patrolling nothing. You know, they're protecting no one, at least visibly. It is, to me, as startling, as scary as anything in the first movie.
I don't think it was as scary because it's cleanup. It's done. The first one was empty because there was danger. This one is empty, but the military has come in. It feels like we're one step away from having Bush there with a mission accomplished banner.
Which the mission wasn't accomplished, by the way, and neither is this one. I mean, it should be pointed out. There's a green zone, or they call it a security zone. There's an area of the city that's secure, and then there's the rest of it that they really, truly don't know. They haven't seen infected. They know how long they last. They eventually die of hunger. The likelihood that there's infected out there is not good. But, yeah, I mean, come on, we're in a sequel. We know that they're not going to just rebuild this city. We know that the infected are going to come back. And where are they going to come from? I get that tension right here early and often with these London shots.
Were you guys put on edge seeing this military presence because of that last film where the military ends up being really worse than the infected? And I think you're right, Stuart. There is a tension here. You got the snipers at the top of buildings, and I'm on edge because the military's back and they weren't good last time.
Yeah, that has me more nervous than this empty city. The empty city to me felt like a reprise. They've already brought back that theme. During that opening chase, the best music from the first one, they bring it back early. And it's played, I would almost say, too much in this one. And now they have the empty city. To me, these felt like callbacks. Like, remember what you liked about the first one? Here it is. And then the military, that's where I'm like, okay, the military are going to be the bad guys again. So I'm a little confused when I see it's Jeremy Renner and the guy from Lost joking around. It's like, oh, well, maybe not all of them.
Yeah, but did you recognize him as a good guy? I mean, the first time. Obviously now that he's the newborn and he's Hawkeye and he has been anointed leading man status, Back then, he would have just been some guy that was, you know, mucking around and scaring his co-workers. The camera hovers a little bit more around him than the helicopter guy. There's reason to believe that he's important. I wouldn't say that any of these people are as identifiable as heroes. In fact, I would say, by singling this out as an American-led NATO operation, they are calling out the bad guys. This could just as easily be the New West.
Yeah, I didn't get a sense that Jeremy Renner was going to be our hero because I had no idea who he was back then. He's kind of creepy at the beginning here. He's saying, hey, what's on TV tonight? And then looking at people through his scope, watching people have sex, watching children get into bed. It's a real eerie feeling. And I know where this is going now, but when I originally saw this, I had a very bad feeling about him.
Yeah, it's really telling that the perspective they have of the city is through a sniper rifle. I mean, that says everything. I mean, in London, no less, a city that does not have guns and now is filled with them by Americans who aren't taking this very seriously and are playing jokes. It puts you on edge. It makes you feel for these people, not for the soldiers. I get a real bad sense about the soldiers.
Yeah, when he's watching the couple have sex in the window, I instantly, even this time, knowing who he is, think he's a scumball. But then he takes the sniper rifle away and just looks in other windows. So he's a peeping Tom, but not a perv.
He's not a peeping Tom. This is what they're here to do. That's what they're quote-unquote protecting. I mean, that's why they're not taking it seriously, is because there doesn't seem to be any really need for them. War is over, right? Why are they here? There's a whole lack of investment, I would say, in the part of the soldiers. They weren't there the first time. They didn't know what it was like to see the city swarming with infected. And so they can't possibly understand what the trauma is going through for the people returning now. I think only one person on the whole team is sympathetic, and that's Scarlett, the medical officer.
And there's very little of her in these opening scenes. We don't get to really know her until the mother shows up, right? I mean, she's shown, but we don't have too much of her.
Right.
Yeah, that's really where she comes and starts speaking up, and, you know, she gives us some exposition. That's how we get to know her.
There is a cut scene with her in the mess hall and the kids, and she is the one that checks out Andy and notices his two different colored eyes. They give her a moment. I think the fact that she's a woman in a largely led male operation gives her that extra edge of seeming sympathetic. For these kids that have lost their mothers, having her there to welcome them makes her seem like she's going to play a more heroic role than Jeremy Renner.
Despite all the army people, it seems to me the focus is very much on Tammy and Andy. We see them come into London, we're introduced to Scarlett through them, and they meet up with Don, who turns out to be their father, and I'm a little shocked because he didn't seem like the type for kids in that first scene.
Yeah, I wonder where they are. Where were they during that breakout?
They mentioned that in that scene. There's a moment where they're looking at photographs, and it's of the old couple and their children, and they're just having an exchange talking about, do you think they're okay? We don't know what that means because we don't know who they are, but reflecting upon that now, it makes a lot of sense. You're exactly right. They were a couple that was separated from their children during a crisis, and that made Alice want to protect this child that ran to the cottage. That is what made her, you could call it a weakness, or at least more empathetic, it's what made her stay behind in the house and get trapped, whereas Don escaped. Now, why? Maybe they were at summer camp. I don't know that they ever give us an exact reason why the kids weren't at home. But yeah, my sense is that they were off doing other things when the infected happened. You know, life happens. You're not always by your parents when you're at that age.
Yeah, it seems that they are somewhere in a protected area as they're brought back very methodically. And Don, I'm assuming he somehow got to that area and he was just brought back earlier. I mean, keep in mind, a lot of time has passed. Don didn't just get off the boat and go to this building. He had to have found civilization and somewhere applied for the custodial job.
Right. 28 weeks means 7 months, basically, which is a long enough time to believe that, yes, he would have been rescued while he was traveling down the river and has just probably played a role in the reconstruction this whole time. He probably never went to the Spanish internment camps that so many people that were evacuated. Because it is mentioned that a lot of London was evacuated. It wasn't like everyone was killed. A lot of people were just flown off of the island. And that's where the kids were. He's probably remained in England the whole time. And so, yeah, he just sort of worked his way up to be the guy with the badge that can get in anything. It seems like a natural fit. Is it a little contrived? I suppose they need to do it for the story they're going to tell. But, you know, I totally buy it. I totally buy all of this opening and this setup.
Yeah, one of the things I really like about this whole setup is there's at least the illusion that they've won. Humans have won. They've found a way to starve off the infected. And that's what's pulling me in. There isn't that great opening or the great shots of empty London like the first film. But there's this intriguement on my part. Okay, how are we going to get back to this outbreak? Things are looking pretty good. People are coming back into the city. The infected are all dead. How is this going to become a rage-infected film?
Yeah, why don't I feel good about what I'm watching? That's what I keep asking. Like, why is it that everything that I see scaring me, even though I'm being told there's nothing to be afraid of anymore? The danger has passed. But yeah, when I see the little kids in their new cool apartment and they're running up to the window and pressing their hands on the glass, you can see it in Don's face. He's reminded of that last image he has of his wife. He's reminded of the danger that was. And we know it's coming. This is a sequel. They're not going to make it without the infected. They'll make it without Danny Boyle. But somebody with red eyes is going to come from somewhere. I know it.
And I'm a little shocked at who it is, but I'm not shocked at how it happens. You've got these kids. Kids always bring on the danger. I mean, Return of the Living Dead 2, anything by Spielberg in the 80s. So when the two go out to, I guess, steal photos of their mother because Andy's afraid he won't remember what she looks like, I know that this is going to be the problem. What I don't expect is that Mom is alive but infected. I kind of figured, because we don't see her die, and that's kind of the movie rule. We see her get sucked away from a window, but we don't see a body. I wondered what would happen to her. She's there. And even watching it again, I mean, it's been 6 years since I saw this. I couldn't remember. And I'm sitting there wondering, is she infected? She's definitely feral.
I had the same reaction now as then. You're right. Enough time had passed that I had forgotten what the trigger was. So when Tammy's gone upstairs and we see something and crouching behind the bed or whatever it is, and it hugs her, it's just a chain of horror. Because I think, A, the infected's going to get her, and oh my God, the infected is her mom. She didn't die at all. Immediately, it changes the whole stakes of the scenario. It changes everything for Tammy, because now she has to recognize that that story her father told her, if she didn't entirely believe it or not, she knows now for sure it was a total lie.
And the only hint we've been given, if you're really paying attention, is when Andy comes into the city, they go, oh, you have a green eye and a brown eye. That's a genetic mutation. It's very special. And it's so in passing that I heard it the first time. I didn't think much of it. But we see this mom appear. I'm not thinking of that piece of exposition. I'm focusing on how she's hugging her son. And it's getting tighter and tighter and tighter. And you're wondering if she's turning then or what's going on. A lot of tension.
Yeah, and I'm thinking she's not infected, because if she was infected, it would be an attack immediately. But I'm also wondering if she's just starving. She may have been one of the later ones turned. Maybe she's not attacking because we saw at the end of 28 Days Later how they were famished and barely able to move. So I'm wondering, is she infected but hungry? Is she uninfected but crazy? Or what's going on? And I had completely blanked option number three. She's infected, but not
a carrier. Yeah, she's not rabid. She doesn't have rage. She has some kind of emotional output. It begs a lot of questions this movie dodges, and maybe that's the right choice. Maybe not knowing makes it more ominous. But by being a carrier, what does that mean for her? Is she completely normal and she's just hungry and glad to see her kids here? Or is there some kind of something burbling under her that's not quite rage that also has affected her behavior? She doesn't act right. I can say that honestly. At no point in the remaining of her screen time do I feel like she has returned to be the person I saw in that cottage in the opening here. She seems affected. I just can't tell whether that's by contracting the virus or just being a survivor with trauma.
Yeah, I always took it as trauma, but what I love about this twist, this turn that it takes, where you have carriers, but they're not infected themselves. They're not crazy trying to bite you. You know, sequel, bigger. Yeah, now here's this added layer of horror where you're suspect of everyone now, that you could have people that by merely kissing them, they turn you into a crazy monster.
And I just want to say, how unfair is it that two different colored eyes get you off of this? You mean to tell me that, I mean, I've known someone with this condition. I don't know how common it is. I think I've only known one person in my life, and David Bowie having this condition. And that is not fair. She does not deserve to survive the zombie apocalypse. It is just not fair to that girl that's going to live and I'm going to get infected.
Okay, Don. What I think I may have misunderstood the first time I watched this movie, though, and was very clear upon the rewatch, is that she does not mean to infect Don.
No.
I thought the first time that this was all a trap, that she wanted revenge. She knew he left her, and she wanted to get him back. That's how I read it the first time. Especially since she kind of bites his lip a little bit. They're kissing. He starts to pull away. His lip is in her teeth. But I think it's because I hadn't seen 28 Days Later in a while. Having watched it just last week for last week's show, and now watching this one, I'm like, ah, it's the spit.
Yeah, I was wondering that same thing. I was watching it this time, kind of knowing the beats it was going to take. I was wondering, is she going to do this on purpose? Does she know what's in her? Is this a revenge for leaving her behind all those weeks ago? But no, as the scene plays out, it wasn't intended. She was just kissing her husband.
Yeah, she has that bloody tear.
Yeah, she's trying to forgive him. I mean, she has a lot of resentment, and maybe rightfully so. He did abandon her, and I think that she holds that against him. But I think that if she were not a carrier, they'd kiss, make up, and go see their kids. I do think that they would have gone on and had a life together. The only thing is, the military has already decided she's too big a risk. Stone has already told our medical officer, our heroine, that, well, maybe she could develop a cure or not, but the best cure is annihilation. They're going to come shoot her anyway. So Alice was never going to make it. I guess that's what I have to tell myself to feel better with how terrible this moment feels, to watch her husband rage out in front of her and then rip her life away. She survived all of these weeks only to be strapped to a table and killed by the man that abandoned her. What a horrible way to go.
And again, there's another callback, another greatest hits from 28 Days Later as he does the double thumb in the eye socket, just like Jim did to that army guy.
Yeah, this is when I said I don't think this film is trying to get us to sympathize with Don. When he rages out, like, we saw the rage infected, they'd bite you, throw you to the ground. He really takes it out on his wife. This is extremely violent. Bites out her throat, gouges her eyes. After she's dead, he just starts pounding her head out of control. There is just something primal and just so sickening with how he attacks her. I don't think we've ever seen an infected attack someone as violently as he does with his wife.
It's a heartbreaker. I feel for this couple. I'm horrified by the violence I'm watching. I like the callbacks of it. Arnie, it sounds to me like on some level this is a complaint that the movie is reaching for these things. I think when you make a sequel, you owe your audience some kind of connection to what was done before. And since so much has changed, since there is no Jim, Selena, or Hannah here, since the circumstances of the outbreak are so vastly different now that large parts of the infected are now dying off or have died off, I think we need those in order to feel that. We need that little musical riff. We need those visuals. I mean, I don't feel like it's gratuitous. I don't feel like when they go back and say, remember when we did this, it feels like cheap recycling. I mean, it's no Silent Night, Deadly Night 2.
No, it just feels pandering to me. You've got the infected, you've got the London, you've got the universe. Up it. Don't give me what I've gotten before. Up it. You're upping the budget, you're upping the scale, so up it in other ways. Don't give me the same exact score again.
Are you telling me you wouldn't have a musical riff that carries through the series? You would prefer they write a new score each time?
That seems like a weird complaint.
Yeah, come on, Arnie.
Star Wars! Use the Star Wars theme every time. This is a franchise. This is a sequel. You carry things over. I like the continuity here. I like that it doesn't feel like a repeat of that first film. There are little elements here, but I feel like, hey, here is the next chapter in this story. We are taking this a different direction. We had wiped it out. We're going to introduce the virus a different way now. This is in that same universe, but it's not a repeat of what I had already seen.
I will agree with you that I'm liking that they are doing new things. It's the things they're choosing to bring back. It's not like they brought back the main theme from the last one. They brought back the most memorable music from the last one, but it was only in one scene of the last one. And here, they bring it back four or five times.
It's a great piece of music! I'm glad they do!
And I love that music. I love it completely, but it means so much to me as part of the scene in which it was used that the more you use it, it waters it down. And that's what I'm feeling about this sequel, is it's just a little bit watered down and trying to make me remember the first one, which the first one is phenomenal. This one, I'm enjoying the ride. I'm really happy when the infected come. And my God, you say it's brutal when he kills Annie. It's brutal what happens after that. That is just mass carnage. It is the carnage we didn't get to see last time.
Oh yeah, I'll give you this. I think this film takes maybe a little too long to ramp up. It takes almost 45 minutes until we get someone infected in the film. And I don't know if it needed to take that long to set up this new situation. But man, once we get someone infected, I'm surprised I don't have a heart attack. This thing takes you for a ride. It is intense. And you're right. This is what we didn't see while Jim was passed out in the hospital.
There was a story that Mike, Selena's friend, told about how he was at an airport with his sister or some relative, and how a crowd slowly changed as an infected were introduced into it, and there was nowhere to go. It was bodies upon bodies just devouring each other. That was a haunting image just for him to describe. Now we're actually going to see it. This is the right kind of callback, where we're going to do it, but we're going to give it to you in a more shocking way. I don't think that you could claim that this movie is more sentimental than the last one. I think it is just as tough and nihilistic, maybe even more so than the last movie. They did not soften up here by creating these new characters. Even though that they're children, what they're living through is just as terrifying as what Jim had to live through. And yeah, this is a nightmare when they're in the quarantine area with the rest of the people in the hotel, and suddenly, bang, 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 Don's at the door.
Yeah, what I like about the twist here is 28 days later, the whole second act, it was like a family road trip. We got all that stuff in the countryside and picnics and grocery shopping. It was a very different vibe. Here, it is that family unit that is so dangerous. It's the father coming back. And I said before, the kind of horror that really gets me is seeing society at the brink. So when you get this group of people shoved into this, what was this, a garage or just some big room, locked in there, panicking, and then this outbreak, this is the kind of stuff that sends chills down my spine, where there's nowhere to go, you're trampling each other. This, to me, is intense stuff.
This is, to me, I think, the most terrifying concept I could have had as a child, and that is that my parent would try to kill me. It was the conflict they introduced at the beginning when the child ran up to the cottage, and it's now what's befalling Timmy and Andy. It's a very Shining scenario. All of a sudden, the person I most trusted in the world is a betrayer who wants to kill me. I mean, that is just, as a child and now, just a horrifying conflict. And they just do not back away from how scary this is. The rest of this movie is really about Don relentlessly trying to pursue and murder his children like he did his wife.
And that's a problem for me. I think that it's a little bit silly that Don is after them. He's stalking them. From what we've seen, the rage virus makes people just completely crazy, so that he feels more targeted than anybody else, that he keeps coming after them. And the fact is, my understanding of the rage virus is he can't come after them. It just is coincidence after coincidence that they keep running into the same guy.
I don't get that sense. I get the sense that he has got their sense and will not let them go, that he is actively pursuing them, that it is about getting specifically Andy, it seems like.
Yeah, you know what, Arnie? I kind of agree with you. He keeps showing up out of nowhere. I mean, we get to the end of the film with, I guess they're in the tunnel or whatever, and he's going to show up again. But I like how it plays thematically. I like that it's about this obsessive family love. I mean, we talk about with Romero, why do zombies go back to the mall? Because that's something they remember. And I guess maybe I'm projecting that, but I like this idea that Don still has this obsession for his family, but now it's been twisted. So Arnie, I agree with the story sense. It doesn't make the most sense, but I like the theme.
And we already saw this. I mean, keep in mind, they found the mother back at the house. What had drawn her there, even though I'm not sure that the virus hasn't changed her thinking, I'm not sure that she is the person that she was before she was infected. I do feel like in this virus, the one that she's transmitting, you do retain a sense of who you were before. It's just that you're rage-filled. It's just that now it's violence that fuels you and not just nostalgia.
Yeah, but when there were no people left in London, we didn't find the infected going home and pacing angrily. You know, it was far more mindless. They all just went to the church and fed on corpses. It's a great idea when used in The Shining and things. Here, and this is a minor gripe, but every time Don showed up, I knew he was the big bad. I just don't see why there is a big bad infected, why there's a nemesis of the infected. The thing that makes the infected unstoppable is their numbers. As we pointed out last time, you could just shoot one in the knee and they're done. So the fact that there had to be this nemesis, a boss infected, if you will.
Let me ask you this, Arnie. Is it the fact that what bothers you is that it's out of continuity with what we've seen before, or that it's a conflict about a father pursuing the kids and you would rather it be faceless masses pursuing the kids?
I have no problem with a movie about father pursuing the kids done well, Shining. I have no problem with masses pursuing the kids. It's not out of continuity with the last film. It's out of continuity with this one, too. He acts unlike any other infected.
I don't know that we know that because I don't know that we've had a relationship with anyone else that's been infected too long. If Brendan Gleeson from the last movie were allowed to live, would he have stopped Hannah? We don't know that. I think that they've given themselves enough leeway by what they haven't told us for me to buy into this. And I love the conflict. I love the fact that this is what fuels the rest of the movie.
But there is the new family unit formed. I mean, because the army has decided to firebomb the city, which is just as harsh as the last film, the kids end up with Scarlet, who's taking them because they're the last hope for a cure, because they may have the mother's genes, and Doyle, who just decided, I'm not into killing right now. I'm gonna make a run for it. That is also a little bit of a strange choice that he just leaves his post and runs down to help them, but I like it.
They were told all targets free. They were just shooting indiscriminately. And again, I get that this is a military operation. Rationally, that makes a whole lot of sense. You got an outbreak and you can't tell who's who. You're going to start shooting just whatever to stop it. And yet at the same time, emotionally, it is gut-wrenching. It is sick. I am physically feeling disturbed when the military just starts shooting everyone. I do not blame Doyle for wanting to get out of that situation.
No, the army's trying to turn him into a rage monster. Kill everything. Shoot everything. Now, there might be a cold logic to that, but he's human. He's a human being. He cannot do that. And we respect the fact that he is too weak to be that killing machine. I think that that is what makes him the hero.
And he truly is the hero because he's the only one who actually has survival skills. While Scarlet is military, she's a scientist. And so when there's snipers on the roof, it's Doyle who knows how to take them out and what people have to do in order to survive. And he becomes the leader of the group. He becomes the good father, whereas the bad father is stalking.
Yeah, and a lot of these scenes, they're really intense. They feel like imagery we would have seen on TV, you know, Zero Dark Thirty kind of stuff. Like, we, at this point in the Iraq War, had seen a lot of images of people storming bunkers and sniper fire. Just lots of stories about soldiers being killed in friendly fire. All of this kind of sickness about this war that at this point is now 4 years into it. Really, as long as 28 Days Later was in American theaters, we've been in Iraq at this point. I really feel like they are channeling and tapping into that. And I don't feel like it's too heavy, and I think it's to their credit. I think it's a less overt metaphor than Romero would have made, but I really feel like the way that they are using our collective feelings about war in this way really helps increase the tension and makes the horror of this story that much more real.
It does have a good reality to it. It feels very grounded. By the same token, it's also exceedingly simple. It is, get to the chopper! That is the MacGuffin here. It is just them surviving obstacles to get to the chopper. It becomes a chase film.
Right. And I love chase films that are about a location, or really any horror movie about a location. It's my favorite thing usually about a good horror movie is a sense of place. I don't know London. I have not visited it extensively, and I don't know the streets well enough to know whether the way that they follow it in and out of the city. I mean, one minute they're out in the country in a carnival, and then they're getting to Wembley Stadium. I don't know if there's a logical progression to it, but to me it feels real. I buy every moment, every turn down an alley, it feels like I am there. And I feel trapped in a way. The claustrophobia of being in a giant city, it's amazing.
And they have a great way of doing the ticking clock thing because of the firebombing. And when the firebombing comes, this is where I really realize what kind of money they're working with. It is really a visual spectacle. It's amazing. And you wonder how anyone or anything could survive. And it seems to have killed all the humans, except for our small band. But the infected survived.
Some of them did, yes. I mean, they're running awfully fast. So even though they burned, I'm sure, a lot of them, all it takes is one.
Now, this whole production, the writers, were they all from the UK?
Or at least European.
Okay. When this firebombing started, I'm like, well, at least it's not an American production company blowing up another country for once.
We blow up our own enough, though. I mean, Washington, D.C., New York, we are equal opportunity destroyers.
I guess after seeing G.I. Joe Retaliation, where we did a number on England, I was glad we weren't the only ones taking it out on them.
I got a question. Did Idris die? I felt like he was in the location. Maybe he wasn't. It wasn't ever quite clear where Idris was. But I felt wherever his headquarters was, where he made all these calls about shoot everyone, it couldn't have been that far from where the firebombs dropped.
I felt like they were in a bunker underground. There were a lot of people there. They were ordering the strike. I felt like they were someplace safe from it. We don't see them again. So perhaps it was a suicide order. Perhaps a code red means everyone's dead, including us. But I thought wherever they were, they didn't act scared. They didn't act like they were having their last minutes. No one was saying a prayer. They just stood there to wait for everyone else to die.
Yeah, they definitely didn't die in some of the explosions because they cut back at least one more time to realize it didn't work. We do get a reaction shot when Idris realizes that they're still infected running down a tunnel, that for all of their might and military savvy, they can't stop determined angry people.
Yeah, and I did think it was a little confusing. I thought the infected were coming in on their military base. I thought he was watching them break in, but no, they were, I guess, just breaking out of District 1, as they call it. They only firebombed this one district, which I guess wasn't all of London. So if you're able to run far enough and fast enough, you could get out of there.
Right. Like our heroes, they were able to use the tunnels. They got out into the fields. Anybody feel like a Ferris wheel ride?
The London Eye.
And this is a sad moment. This is where Tammy realizes that she basically tells Andy, don't have any hope about Mom. I know that you thought that she was alive all those times, and she was, but now she's dead.
And they really drive that home that the cure is gone. That's what I'm getting when the whole city is bombed. I'm not mourning the thousands who die, infected or not. But they show us the close-up of the body burning and even the blood samples they took exploding from the heat. The chance for a cure to infection is gone. At least that's what they're trying to sell for a short period of time before they finally have Scarlet call out that these kids may also have that gene.
Not these kids, Andy. He's the one with the two colored eyes. We can only know this much about how carriers work, and that is that when you are infected, both your irises are bloodshot red, and when you have two different colored eyes, they can't turn the same color. So I guess it all comes down to that. Again, David Bowie, kick up your heels. You're going to be fine.
A little bit strange, a little bit stoic. And you can't kiss anyone again, but fine.
You know, one of the iconic scenes for me in this film is when Flynn shows up at these, were they carnival grounds, wherever they're hanging out. And there's that huge horde of the infected. And I get it, totally not plausible, but I've always felt this was like Dawn of the Dead on steroids. We get that scene in Dawn of the Dead with the helicopter. They're getting ready to take off and the zombies are attacking and it chops the head off of one with some poor effects, even probably for the time. But here, you know, you get Flynn, this helicopter pilot, angling the helicopter down, chopping up zombies, total comic book violence. But I really enjoy this part of it. So much of it has been so intense to get this scene. There's almost a comic relief to it, the way it plays out.
Yeah, Flynn's a weird character. I mean, we've seen in the little time that we spent with him that he is a family man. He has a photo of wife and kids back home. He should be more sympathetic for these orphan children. You know, he should have been like, hop on board. But for whatever reason, when he sees them, he's like, no, I'm only here for my sniper buddy. And the rest of you, good luck, but that's it, I guess. The thought is that he's an American out to protect America.
The way I took it was he just couldn't handle the weight. And there's that nameless guy. I'm sure he has a name. I didn't catch it.
Sam.
Who jumps on the propeller. I know he's dead meat. He's a coward who won't run out to draw sniper fire. I wouldn't either, for the record. But that makes him meat instantly. I don't bother getting to know him. We hadn't seen him before. We're not going to see him again. So I get that with all of these adults and these kids, it is just too much to get on the chopper. And that coward guy wasn't just going to be selfless. And at that point, neither was Doyle, because he doesn't understand the kid's importance. So the only one who'd be like, take the kids and leave me is Scarlet, and the chopper can't handle all those people.
I'm not sure if I buy that the chopper couldn't take the weight. I really felt like it was more pushback by him. But I'm surprised by the turn of events here, because you're right, Jacob. Once he starts chopping off heads, I'm like, this is amazing, but this is going to get him killed. I thought for sure this is where the chopper crashes, and we lose the hope that Flynn's going to be able to fly them away, and they're going to have to figure something else out. But no, it just ends up being about, all right, I'll catch you over at Wembley.
Yeah, and that was a little frustrating. It was like, okay, we got to the chopper. So now let's get to the chopper.
Yeah. As nihilistic as this movie is, they didn't take away that hope that they could fly away, basically because the screenwriters didn't really have any other idea about how to get these people out of London. They knew that they wanted to, but maybe they could have come up with something else. It would have certainly been an even more intense horror if we realized that there was no more Flynn to take them away. Maybe they wouldn't have continued on. You know, it should be pointed out that Scarlet was shot. She's limping here. I'm thinking that she may not make it to the end, but maybe she's Michael Bayne in Aliens. Maybe she can, but she won't be the protector. It's really going to fall to these kids to protect each other. They've made that pact at this point. For the rest of the movie, no matter what happens, Tammy has promised Andy she's not going to leave him. And so it continues on into a really scary scene with poison gas clouds.
Yeah, and what happens here, I did not see coming. I saw this when it came out in theaters. I've probably seen it once since. And how this plays out caught me by surprise again. Couldn't believe this is where they went with it.
This is the one thing I remembered about this movie for precisely that reason. It is just beyond what I was prepared for. I did not think that Doyle was going to get it this early, but he's a martyr. He sacrifices himself. They find a car to hide out in and close the vents. And I just think it's bad enough that they've got to, you know, breathe what's going on here. But then they got these Romero crazy style people with flamethrowers and gas masks patrolling to burn anything in sight. And he's got to push the car. Man, it's just a tough moment watching him burn as he sends them off to freedom.
This is the hardest death in the movie for me. This one is right there with as hard as anything in the first movie, because he doesn't die quick. He's still running when on fire, and he falls to his knees. Again, they got the money here to do it, and it just lasted long enough for me to think about that being my method of death and shudder as the car drives away.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest shocks is that he doesn't get it from the infected. It's his own. It's the military going through cleaning up. He's a casualty of friendly fire, which is probably much more tragic than, you know, lasting through a war and getting killed by the enemy. It's getting killed by your own.
Yeah, and he dies heroically in that he's helping the others escape. The same as we've seen in so many zombie movies where the person locks themselves in or stays with the grenade to kill the others. He helps them escape, but it feels less heroic because he's not taking any of them with him. He's just pushing a car and burning up for it. And he doesn't do it intentionally. He is martyred, but his intention isn't to die. I know he realizes the odds are long, but he's running and he thinks he can get back in that car and he just doesn't quite make it.
No, he says the line like, I'll meet you there. I think he knows that he's not getting in the car, but yeah, maybe he's hoping he can get to the chopper, but he didn't get back to Wembley. And the one thing that I find that maybe it makes me feel a little bit better here, but it seems less harsh than Romero. It's not as judgmental. You know, when they kill Ben at the end, I think we really blame the rubes. They acted too soon. They were racist and he was a black man. Or, you know, there's just something built into that conflict that we feel like those people made a bad call and an innocent man died. Here, I feel for these guys in the gas mask. Can you imagine being ordered to walk through a poison cloud and kill anything that runs at you? I mean, it's not like they were trying to kill Doyle. Everyone is just trying to do their job, and it's just leading to more and more tragedy.
I don't have a lot of sympathy for them, no. I mean, if I were to have sympathy for them, they would all do what Doyle did and reject the orders. They're walking through the streets like stormtroopers, killing anything that moves. Not really going to empathize with the faceless guys in the suits.
But come on, keep in mind, what's probably moving in a poison cloud is the infected. I mean, that's what I would assume. I wouldn't think that it would be innocents at this point that you're going to meet.
That said, I will say I am surprised with the expediency that this movie whittles down the characters to three. because I felt for quite a while that there were a lot of people, a lot of players in this movie. And then when the infected start tearing out, the part of me that's been doing now playing for 6 years goes, oh yes, here's where they take it down to the main characters. But that main character group is still like half a dozen people, including the coward. I'm surprised how quickly it goes from 6 to 3.
Yeah, Scarlet is not going to make it either. She gets him as far as the bottom of a tube staircase. She, again, guided by sniper sights, you know, she's using the night vision on her gun to get these kids to safety. I mean, I love the way that this director is showing that salvation is through the viewpoint of a gun. I mean, it just makes everything feel so conflicted here. But yeah, Andy falls down. Everyone gets lost in the dark.
What I find funny is they're like going over charred bodies on a staircase or a stalled escalator, and Tammy falls and disappears, and then they can't find her. And I'm like, nah, I mean, it's realistic that somebody could die from a fall down the stairs, but you're not going to do that in this movie. You're not going to take a main character and kill them from a fall down a flight of stairs. But they take her out for a while that way.
Yeah, this is the scene that I really remember from viewing it before, is this night vision. I mean, people always look freaky in night vision. I don't know why you'd ever buy, I don't care how much you like the celebrity, night vision sex tape is not going to look good. Their eyes are all beady. I mean, they already look like monsters through this night vision. I remember the dark, and what I love is how the characters are screaming and reacting. They don't know what they're touching, but we do. It's just a great setup here, going through the dark, trying to be guided over these dead bodies, just yelling in panic and claustrophobia. I mean, underground, this is like a grave they're in. These are catacombs they're climbing through.
I might feel cheated that we're already at the end here. This is the climax of the film, it should be pointed out. This is the last battle we're going to get. But I have had such heart palpitations watching all of this. It's a relief to find out so quickly that, yes, Scarlet is dead and Tammy's getting the gun. And now Don is dead. The only question that remains, what's going to happen to Andy? And there is some weird cutscene. Did you guys see it about Andy? I'm not sure where they would have placed it in the movie, but he has sort of a panic in which he feels like he's doomed to be what the infected are, and he has a dream about his mother on a train. It didn't really add to the movie, but there is an extra scene here trying to take from his perspective.
I saw that, and even in the commentary for that scene, the director said he wasn't sure where it was going to be placed. Where they kind of placed it is after he gets bitten. This is like what he sees as the infection is coursing through his body, and he's running through a subway tunnel into the arms of his mother, or the protection of her genes, is how I take it. So it makes sense metaphorically that that's the place to put it, but yeah, I'm glad they cut it. I was surprised that he got bit, but then it hit me. I didn't get what you're saying, Stuart, this whole time about Andy being the special one. I just got that these kids could carry the gene. As soon as he gets bit is when I realize that whole eye thing, and he's fine.
Right.
And I do love how Tammy takes out Don. I mean, that headshot. This is a movie filled with really gory headshots. If you're a gore hound, you're going to get off on this film.
Yeah, I think this movie is much less sympathetic than 28 Days Later. As brutal as that ending was, I felt like those deaths were justified. This one, you have family against family. There's something almost more brutal and with less hope. Again, those picnics and grocery shopping, here we never have that. Here, the family unit is always something that's attacking each other. I don't think they're going to be making a banner saying hello at the end of this film.
That's exactly right. And when I first saw this movie, I thought it was scarier than 28 Days Later. I thought it was a sequel that was better than the original because it had gotten to me in ways that even that first movie hadn't, because they played upon this conflict. I was broken. By the time they get to the overgrown Wembley Field and Flynn is there, I just don't think that I can take another attack. I don't know what's going to happen next, but he relents. He realizes that his friends are not there, and these kids don't weigh much, and he goes against orders, and everyone pays.
Now, Arnie, you said that this attack in Paris is because they went through the tunnel. I never got that. I got that we see the helicopter crashed. I don't know, maybe Andy sneezed, and you know, he didn't cover his mouth, and some saliva went all over everyone. That's how I had always taken that somehow he carried it over to Paris.
That's absolutely what happened. Absolutely. There would have been no reason to believe with them repopulating London that they would have lifted the gates and allowed traffic from Paris and what have you, from the continent, into the UK. There's no way. It would have still been courted off. It would have still been impossible for anything, infected or not, to cross that border. It is because Flynn made the sympathetic choice, one of the few made in this movie, to take care of a child that infection's able to do what they couldn't imagine happening in the first movie. If you remember, at a pivotal moment, Jim says there's no way it could be outside of England because there's no way infected could get on an airplane and cross countries. Well, there is a way, and it's called compassion.
See, I didn't read it like that, either viewing. I guess it makes sense that he could be the reason. And I did wonder, even though Andy survived, Andy's immune, I was feeling bad for Andy because even though he's not a rage-filled beast, he will be a lab rat and he can't spit on anyone, can't kiss anyone. What if he bleeds? There is that danger with him, but I didn't get that he became patient zero just like his father that carried it to Paris. I thought since we saw so many infected in a tunnel that they just made it through because London is connected to Paris.
But that would have been closed off. I mean, obviously, there was infected before and they never got off. There's no reason to believe that these infected would have gotten off. Then again, maybe we're projecting into this. All we saw were a bunch of angry people at the Eiffel Tower. Maybe they're just French soccer hooligans.
I mean, I do like this ending, though. This feels like, okay, if we're going to make this a franchise, this is how we get it out. This is how we go for that third part. This is how it gets out of England and goes worldwide. We're going to be talking about World War Z later on. This is how it feels like you expand this story. This is how we get to 28 months later.
Yeah, it definitely feels like a hook for a sequel that, as we discussed last podcast, may never happen, although it may. And if it does, we will cover it. So, Jacob Stewart, do you recommend 28 Weeks Later, Jacob?
I think 28 Weeks Later, not as tightly paced as that film last week. That film, just every moment I was into it. This one, it takes a while to get going. Like I said, it's about 45 minutes till we really get into this widespread infection. And I think that could have been trimmed down. But once we get into that, this film, at times, is much more intense than 28 Days ever was. I think 28 Days is the better film. It's better constructed. We talked about so many technical aspects that worked for that. But like I said, I need to start working out before I watch this film because there are times I feel like my heart is about to give out. There is some intense scenery here. There's some intense action here, and it's gripping. It holds my attention once that action really gets moving. It's brutal. It's violent. It's hard to watch at times. This is a much darker film. It's weird saying that with 28 Days Later that, hey, this is the darker one, but I think it is. There's less hope in this one. That film, there is that hope at the end. There is the surrogate father and mother with their daughter. Here, it's two lonely children in an infected Paris as this infection goes worldwide. There's something darker here, but I don't think it's the better of the films, but still a highly recommended film.
Stuart.
Yeah, my memory was that this was the better film. Part of that was due to the fact that I remember thinking that the third act of the first one was a little bit flawed, and part of it was just the sheer terror that this movie sent me on. This middle of this movie is about as scary as a movie can be, honestly. It's about as scary as you can have, recognizing that you're just a person watching images on a screen. But you forget all of that. I project myself into these kids. I think where the first one really has it up on this one is that Jim was a much more relatable character. Selena, those characters were stronger. And here in this movie, because they've chosen children, because the person that we first identify with ends up being the bad guy, we aren't as invested in them as individuals. They're just more like types. They're just innocent children in peril. I think that's what makes 28 Days Later a slightly better film. But you know what? We're in the Batman Begins, Dark Knight kind of quandary here of two terrific movies that I absolutely love. On any given day, I might say one's better than the other, but they're both fantastic and a strong, strong recommend for 28 Weeks and 28 Days Later.
I give this film a solid recommend, and I agree with all the criticisms both of you voiced. What I don't agree with is the exuberance and the extremities you guys are going through to praise this film for being so harsh and everything. I don't get that from this film. To me, 28 Days Later, yes, that's a film that is hard for me to watch. 28 Weeks Later, to me, feels far more rote. To me, this is a massive step down from 28 Days Later. It's still a solid recommend, but understand, when you take one of the films that I consider to be such an intense, gripping experience, one of the best films I've ever had the pleasure of reviewing on Now Playing, and then you give me just a solid sequel, it's a huge step down. This film is a good film. 28 Weeks Later is a good film, but it's far more rote, in my opinion, than 28 Days Later. It follows more tropes, it's doing more of what we've seen before, not just in the first 28 film, but in so many other zombie films. There's the holes in logic as to why Don keeps showing up. Yes, it fits the theme, but it doesn't make sense. There's the redundancy of having to get to the chopper twice. There's the fact that it takes a while to get going, and then when it does get going, it does feel over too soon. Feeling over too soon is the sign of a good movie. This is a good movie. It's not a great one, but it is a recommend, and I hope that if they do it again, they bring Danny Boyle back full time. I think that what was lacking was his special touch. He was involved in this, but he didn't direct this. I don't want to see 28 Months Later unless he's back in both cases, because I don't want to see this franchise take a third step down. I don't even want to see another 28 Weeks Later, even though it's good. I've seen it. I want to see it back elevated to where it was the first time.
So why haven't we got 28 Months Later? Why has it been? We're going on 6 years now.
Danny Boyle hasn't been bored, and like I said last time, there are some rights issues. Apparently, two different people own the rights to 28 Days Later, and 28 Weeks Later, it made money, but when it was over in theaters, the studio said, well, based on theatrical release, let's see how it does on home video to determine if we're going to really greenlight a third one. So it didn't make the money to make everybody jump up and down saying, let's prioritize this and work out our personal differences so the rights can happen. And the people for whom it's a passion, like Danny Boyle, have an uphill battle because of the rights.
Not only that, but if they're going to go from where they set themselves up for, it's going to be really expensive. They're going to need a budget like World War Z in order to show us a global pandemic of rage-infected people. You've really got to have more money than you probably could ever earn back. Let's face it, World War Z may be a great movie. They're never going to make their coin back. No horror movie has ever made what the budget is that it's going to take to give us this vision. So I'm appreciative of the fact that we're going to get a huge epic next week, but there's just no way to fund this kind of global disaster with zombies. There's no precedent. If World War Z ends up making money, I bet you we do get 28 Months Later, but I just don't see it happening.
If anyone could make it happen, I think it would be Danny Boyle. I mean, the fact that he made London appear deserted and gave us everything he gave us in that first film on such a low budget makes me think he could stretch a dollar. And the man has a lot of respect for all of his work he's done since. But yeah, if we thought it was really in the cards, we wouldn't be covering them now.
Yeah, I think that this series is done, and I'm okay with that. I mean, I think they went out on top. They made two excellent, terrifying, apocalyptic thrillers, and I'm grateful that we were able to cover them.
And I'm thankful for our donors who gave us a donation so they could hear us cover them. This is our goodbye to our gold donors. We have one more show in our spring donation drive, like Stuart said, next week, World War Z, that goes out to silver and gold donors. But to you gold donors specifically, thank you so much for your support. It means so much to us, and we hope that you have enjoyed the past 7 weeks of content.
Yes, and even though it would be unrealistic to think that we're going to have the show out by next Friday, the movie opens next Friday. I may not have even seen it by that time. We will try and have the podcast out as soon as possible. But to tide you over, next Friday, I'll be covering World War Z, the novel, the thing that allegedly inspired this Brad Pitt movie. It was a book first, and I've read it, and we'll be covering it Friday, Books and Nachos, next week.
So until World War Z, just remember, they're dead. And you're gonna be next.
Yes.
We have to leave now. More infected will be coming. They always do.
Once again, thank you for supporting Now Playing, and we hope you've enjoyed this episode in the 28 Days Later and 28 Weeks Later retrospective series.
No, look. I mean thank you.
And I mean show.
Your support helps keep Now Playing on the air.
There are no survivors. It's just us in here and them out there.
The film discussed in this podcast is the property of its respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended.
What about the government? What are they doing?
There's no government.
Of course there's a government. There's always a government.
The opinions expressed in Now Playing are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the opinion of Venganza Media Incorporated.
Plans are pointless. Staying alive's as good as it gets.
Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2013, all rights reserved, and no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated.
Now they won't stop until everyone is dead.
Weeks. Yeah.
Or weeks.
The star-studded film.
Yeah, we got a... Now it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think it was at the time, but yeah, I was surprised. We got, what, Moira Taggart in this one?
I know. Moira Taggart, Heimdall, Hawkeye as a sniper, and hell, Imogen Poots would get golden headphones later this year if we still gave them.
Viva Vendetta and Fright Night, yes. Mm-hmm.
For somebody who's vaguely attractive, but I have no idea who she is. She's in a lot of films.
I'm hitting record.
Jacob, you good?
I am recording.
Okay.
Today we're discussing...
Hold on. I'm getting the cast list.
I just thought, you know, rush. Okay.
Die, and eventually it's down to Scarlet, Andy, and Timmy. Down to Scarlet,
Tammy.
Andy, and Tammy. And Lassie. Lassie, did Timmy fall down the London Underground again? Boarded up cat. Not cabbage. Oh, they're in a boarded up.
Well, I just wanted to say, I don't feel so... let me start over. When this fire bar...